You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, episode number 138. Filmmakers are going to make films, just like painters are going to paint. Richard Linklater.
Broadcasting from a dark, windowless room in Hollywood, when we really should be working on that next draft. It's the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast, showing you the craft and business of screenwriting while teaching you how to make your screenplay bulletproof. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Now, today's show is sponsored by Bulletproof Script Coverage. Now, unlike other script coverage services, Bulletproof Script Coverage actually focuses on the kind of project you are and the goals of the project you are. So we actually break it down by three categories: micro budget, indie film market, and studio film. There's no reason to get coverage from a reader that's used to reading tentpole movies when your movie is going to be done for $100,000. And we wanted to focus on that at Bulletproof Script Coverage. Our readers have worked with Marvel Studios, CAA, WME, NBC, HBO, Disney, Scott Free, Warner Brothers, The Blacklist, and many, many more. So if you need your screenplay or TV script covered by professional readers, head on over to covermyscreenplay.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Today's episode, we're going to be talking to a writer-director who exploded on the scene with his script Buried, starring Ryan Reynolds, back in 2010, and it made a gazillions amounts of money. It was really well done, and it was all in one location, which essentially was a coffin underground, and it was well directed, well shot, and Chris came up with the idea and the script for that, and that launched him into Hollywood and directing his own films. He also worked on a film called The Sea of Trees with the legendary Gus Van Sant, and more recently wrote Greenland, starring Gerald Butler, which I found super fun, and they're already making a sequel to that. And he's produced a bunch of films and just done a ton in Hollywood. And I absolutely had a ball talking to Chris. It was so much fun to go down the rabbit hole with him about, you know, what's going on behind the scenes, how his career kind of came up and then went back down and went back up and then went back down again, and how he's really kind of clawed his way up and hustled his way up to the career that he has today. It's a very inspirational conversation. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Chris Sparling. I'd like to welcome to the show Chris Sparling, man. How you doing, Chris?
I'm good. I'm good. How are you?
Good, man. Good. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. I appreciate you reaching out and wanting to come on the show. That you've been listening to the show a bit and been a fan, and yeah, and you heard a couple of your friends on the show. You're like, hey, I want to jump in on this action.
Yeah. I heard Eddie Burns on, and he was talking about him and Aaron Lubin, who I know. And I was like, man, this sounds fun. I want to do this. And so, yeah, here I am.
Yeah. And we were talking about one of your favorite episodes, Joe Carnahan, who's a friend of the show, and one of the most entertaining episodes I've ever had on the show, without question.
Well, it's easily, I don't know Joe, but it was easily one of the most entertaining episodes I listened to, for sure. That guy was like, I'm like, that guy's fucking cool, man. I want to meet that guy.
Joe is arguably one of the coolest filmmakers I know and have ever met. He is definitely a force of nature, without question. Now, before we jump in, man, how did you get started in the business?
So my thing was, I started as an actor like eons ago by this point. And so I did the struggling actor thing in Rhode Island. That's where I'm from, in LA, for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a tough, tough racket, man. I give credit, a lot of credit, yeah, to people who do that and stick to it long-term. I did it for about 2 years. And it was during that time that Good Will Hunting came out. And so between, like, and you know, honestly, talking about Eddie, like, that, I think McMullen had come out a few years prior and everything. Mm-hmm. So it's like between that and then Good Will Hunting came out, It was like the worst thing in the world and best thing in the world that could have happened to an actor, because all of us started to think we could write our own shit for ourselves. Right. And so, you know, it's not like thinking it would be that easy.
Oh, God.
And so that's what I did. I started writing when I was, you know, as I was trying to go out on auditions and et cetera, et cetera. And so after about 2 years, I headed back home to Rhode Island, which is where I was from, because I had left. I went out to LA. I was really fucking young. I was like 20 years old. So I left college midway through to do this, to chase the dream, as it were. And I was kind of like, man, I'm doing too much. Like, I was taking acting classes. I was working. I was taking school classes, you know, like, and doing all these things. And I'm like, I'm not really excelling at any of these things because I'm doing all of them. I'm like, let me just focus on getting school done, at least kind of recalibrate, regroup, see where I'm at, you know, with the plan of going back to LA, which is exactly what I did. So I went back to the East Coast, finished my degree, and then spent the summer here, then drove cross country back to LA and arrived the night before September 11th.
Jesus.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it was like, as you probably remember, I mean, you know, as it pertains to our business, there was nothing doing for like months and months.
Dead.
Because this is the part I think a lot of people forget about that time, is that's also when the anthrax scare happened. It was right in that same window. So it's not like now where I'd imagine everything is, you know, it is, everything's digital, you know, just you have headshots or whatever else. It's all reels, we're all digital. Back then you were sending out hard copy headshots. And during the anthrax scare, no one was opening mail because they were afraid to. So, I mean, if that's the way you get auditions is, you know, by your headshot and resume going out and no one's open. So it was like, I'm doing nothing out here. Mm-hmm. So 4 months passed and I was like, this ain't it. I just felt completely like I had no control, no agency in my own life. So by that point I'd written more. I was like, you know what? I'm going to move home. I'm going to write a movie that I'm going to direct, produce, star in. I have no idea how to do any of those things really. Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's the only way I can see this working. And that's what I did, frankly. That's what happened.
And that movie was is that the one that Uzi at the Alamo?
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a total fucking shit show. And it's like looking back at your high school, you know, like ninth grade high school picture and going, Jesus, I thought I was all right looking. And I was like, no, you are not. You are not at all good looking.
You know, listen, on a side note, I have to interrupt you for a second. On a side note, I just went back to visit my mom and I hadn't been in my mom's house for fucking a while. And she has my high school picture in a giant frame in the front, circa 1992, blue, like, glamour shot picture, like, you know, yeah. Blue, like, stripes in the neon stripes in the back. And you had the whole look. Oh, my God. Yeah. My daughters were like, Daddy, what is that? Like,
yeah,
I have no idea.
You think you looked all right?
Cavaricci's right? all day.
Cavaricci's not realizing you look like fucking Gargamel.
Absolutely.
So anyway, that movie, you know, I'm gonna add context in just a second, but. I mean, I had never made a movie. I had no business making a movie. I didn't even know how to write a movie, honestly. I'd at least written at least one or two screenplays by that point, but I still didn't know what the hell I was doing. And it's a mini miracle the movie even got finished. It really is. And so that's why I'm saying I want to add some context. So I imagine you and I are roughly the same age. So like you and I kind of straddle the analog and digital world. We were there when it all started to change, right? Mm-hmm. So this was at a time when the digital world started to kind of become a thing, but it still was expensive to make a movie. You know what I mean? It wasn't expensive. Maybe it was to shoot on film, but it still was expensive.
Oh yeah. Right?
And so I think I made that movie all in for like $20,000, which nowadays, if you say that to someone, they're like, $20,000? That you made this piece of shit for $20,000? Like,
what'd you shoot
that's
on?
That's all you can do.
And what did you shoot
I
on?
I shot on the DVX 100.
The DVX was the 100 Acer or the 100? Because obviously there's a difference. You don't remember?
No, it wasn't even the A. It was the DVX 100.
Oh, you got the first gen. You got the first gen. I got my
first generation.
My first film was on the 100A, which, by the way, arguably best little independent film camera ever. It was gorgeous. It was gorgeous looking.
Yeah.
It was the first 24P. And when we saw it, we're like, this is looks just like film. No, it doesn't.
It looks like a movie. I was like, this is amazing, right? But it still wasn't cheap. You know what I mean?
No, it was not.
So it took me about 2.5 years to finish the movie because I shot it in about 2 weeks. Again, I had no business making a movie. I mean, I don't know how people just didn't leave. It was organized. It was organized enough to happen, right? And obviously were treated well and people were paid a little amount of money. But I mean, to ask people to show up day after day, and these aren't, again, I'm shooting this in Rhode Island. These are people that are actors, but they're not full-time actors. They are people that maybe do like community theater or this. This is like kind of a hobby or maybe a little more than that for them. Anyway, it's a fucking shit show, but I love it for what it was at the time. I would not have a career had I not done it.
Frank. So what did that do for your career? Because as you're just saying, I can't believe anyone even looked at that thing. What did that do for your career as a writer and or director?
So it was, again, going back to the time, it was, you know, when you back in the day, it was like, well, if you wanted to contact anyone, it was like the Hollywood Representation Directory, the Hollywood, whatever, those big, thick books. That's something for my mom. So I'm just scouring those books, trying to find representation, trying to find basically just querying everyone under the sun that I think is right for this. Say, will you watch my movie? That's really what I was doing. And I guess the benefit of the time was that unlike now, because it's so easy to create content, the barriers of entry are basically gone. There wasn't as much content. So to reach out to someone if you had a film, it actually was.
It meant something. It's like I've been saying to people a long time, like in the 80s, all you had to do was finish a movie and it was sold. It was sold and you made money. Toxic Avenger got made during that time. I mean, it was theatrically run. It was done. Right. So 90s was a watered down version of that. Now, the waiter or the Uber driver has a feature.
Right. No, so true. But I don't know how many queries I sent out. Maybe 100. I have no idea, but I think I heard back from maybe like 5 people that said, yeah, sure. Send me your movie. And of course, in the meantime, I was trying to get in this festival. Sure. But, of the 5, I heard back from maybe 3. And of the 3, I think 2 said they liked it. And of the 2, one said it was a manager. And he goes, I liked it, man. I laughed out loud. And then the words you always want to hear, what else you're working on? Right. And so that was it. I mean, I was a kid from Rhode Island, man. I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anyone in business. I didn't have any connections. So that was my first open door. Mm-hmm. And it was like, that's it. I'm fucking going. That's it. I'm going to open this door, which will open the next one. And now just fast forward. That's my manager. He's my manager.
Still, I mean, to this day.
Still. Yeah.
That's awesome. That's great. All right. So then you made you wrote a film in 2000, or it came out in 2010 called Buried. Now, I was telling you before we got on the floor, it's like when I saw that trailer and saw the success of that film and everything, as an independent filmmaker, I was like, God damn it. Why didn't I think of that? That's like the easiest, cheapest thing you could shoot. Like it's a dude in a box. Oh my God, why didn't I think about that? And it was kind of revolutionary when it came out, especially for Indian, and that you got Ryan Reynolds and all that stuff. But how did you come up? Was that an original concept of yours?
Yeah. So that was basically the lesson learned from that feature that I made. So I made that, and that movie had all these locations and all these actors. And it's like things I didn't know, man. I didn't know like that stuff. Like I shouldn't be doing that. I don't have the budget. I don't have the time for all that stuff. I just didn't know any better. And like I said, thankfully no one just left the project, which could have happened. But anyway, so this time around I had made a short or two in between. And I mean, it's worth pointing out, I didn't go to film school. So I had no other, practical knowledge of how to do this. But the thing I learned from making that first feature was like, man, this time around, I can't do it that way. Like, I can't have all these locations. I can't have all these actors because A, that shit costs so much money and time. And on top of that, it's like, again, I could run the risk of people just not showing up for work. Mm-hmm. So I was like, all right, well, I have about at this point, I was working like a regular job again. And I'm like, I have like $5,000 that I can save. What movie can I make for $5,000? That's it. And I made the conscious decision by that point, Paranormal Activity had come out. You know, I toyed for a minute about like, well, the found footage thing seems like that's an affordable way to make a movie. I was like, I don't really think I want to do that right now. And so then it just really became like, what movie can you make for $5,000? So naturally it got smaller and smaller and
literally
fewer people. Literally, yeah. And I was like, I was left with a guy in a box on the phone. And I was like, fuck it, man. If I need to do half of the voices that on the phone, I'll do half of the voices. And then who was going to star in it? I don't know. You know, here's something that I don't know if I've ever talked about about Buried. Is at one point, so like this is the like very early on, you know, I'd written the script and I'm thinking I'm going to shoot it in my apartment for $5,000. And I'm like, well, I want to try at least to get some semblance of a name, right? In this movie, I'll try. I don't know if it'll work. And I was thinking like, I was thinking about that some dude from Days of Our Lives, the guy that played Bo. I don't know why. I was thinking like, maybe I can get him. I mean, not to like disparage him as if he's like, I'm scraping the bottom of the barrel. But I mean, I'm thinking like, I'm not going to get a movie star. There's no
just get a face, that. A so face, maybe, somebody. Yeah, yeah, like a face.
Somebody, right? Just to kind of just add some sort of credibility to me. I'm a nobody. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And long story short, so I talked earlier about how my other thing opened the door with that manager. And kind of what happened in the time in between is after that, I'd write a new script. I would send it to him. He would like it, but it wouldn't set the world on fire for him. So he'd be like, well, I liked it, but let's keep talking. And that went on for like three and a half years, Alex, Jesus. Where, you know, and I made maybe a couple more smaller contacts in the meantime. So hustling. Mm-hmm. And so finally, it's like 6 months into pre-production, or at least me figuring out how I'm going to make my $5,000 version of Buried in my apartment. And I didn't send him this script. It was the only script I'd never sent him, because my thinking is, he's like this big Hollywood manager. Like, why is he gonna care about my guy in a box movie? Like, I don't want to risk destroying the relationship I've now spent 3 years cultivating, mm-hmm. right? And you do these things. We've all been there. Everyone listening to you, like, it's like that's been part of the struggle. You're questioning every move. Like, you're overthinking everything, because you think, oh, is this going to be the landmine I step in? Oh, I don't know if I should do that, right? And it just it's such an excruciating process. But anyway, one night, I always call it like it was like the Jerry Maguire moment, where I was looking at my career. You know, I was like, what is going on? Is this ever going to happen? Is this movie going to happen? Is my career going to happen? And I was like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to send it to him. And I did. And he flipped for it. He's like, oh my God, like this script is amazing, dude. Like, what are you doing? What are your plans? I'm like, well, my plan was to make it. And he's like, all right, that's cool. And he's like, but I think this can be a spec that we can go around. Would you be willing, long and short, would you be willing to step back from directing it if we can go out with it as a spec? And naturally, I was like, yeah, man, I'm just trying to break into the business any way I can. So long story short, that's what happened. We went out with it. And this is the crazy thing. So I went from being, I'm sorry for being so long-winded. You know, I went from being a guy from Rhode Island that had no contacts, that was, you know, banging his head, hustling, trying for years, making little progress. That script went out, I don't remember it correctly, it was like March of 2009. The movie was in Sundance 2010.
Yeah, I know. That's insanely fast.
Yes.
So, all right. So you went out and did you get the director attached first? Did you get a producer attached first?
So it all came like, I mean, it's crazy. Like, that's why I drive home the point that it was like almost like a just an overnight sort of flip, where I went from being someone who tried for years to get representation, tried right. all the different things that we do, to all of a sudden, now I have a manager who gets me an agent at UTA, who gets me a high, you know, powered attorney, who this, and all of a sudden I have a.
So, yeah. So like overnight, you basically went from someone who was struggling, and then you have an entire team around you.
Yeah, but the overnight success, if you want to call it that, was like they say, is like 10 years in the making.
Right. But it's just like boom, 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 and all of a sudden there was a switch. And that's what the power of good content will do. A good piece of material will do that for you. So it goes out, you get a producer, you get it. So at what point did Ryan Reynolds get involved? Because Ryan Reynolds was yet, I mean, he was a star, but he wasn't Ryan Reynolds yet. He's definitely not Deadpool Ryan Reynolds.
No. His big thing at that point, he had done The Proposal. Like, so that had really kind of elevated him.
Right.
And I remember, I didn't go to film school. I have my degrees in criminal justice. So at the time I was working doing fraud investigation, which is a boring fucking job.
It sounds like it.
And so I remember, like, by this point I had my team around me. I knew we were, you know, things were happening with my career for the first time, but you know, that's also a weird phase to be in your career where it's like things change, but yet they haven't changed because it seems like something's going to happen, but I'm still working a regular job, you know? And I remember I was doing a case and I'm in my car. Like, you spend a lot of your time in your car doing that shit because you're watching. It's, I don't know, it's a boring job. Anyway, long story short, this is before cell phones, smartphones. So I have my laptop and I'm picking up a Wi-Fi signal from some random person's house, whatever. I'm just stealing their Wi-Fi. And I remember getting an email with a link to a Variety article saying that Ryan Reynolds was on the project, that he had signed on to the project. And I was like, holy shit. I'm like, this is crazy. And I remember like the next day or so, and here's a little cautionary tale, is that I remember I put in my 2 weeks notice because I was like, no, I'm done. No. I made it. Right. And thank God. And like, thank God it actually happened because I was so green at the time. Like, I didn't realize how many thousands of things could have gone wrong at that point for not to happen. But thank God it did.
That's the same. I mean, I feel you because when I was coming up as well, I would have a meeting with a star for a project that I was trying to get off the ground. And then I'm like, I have to go back and, you know, doing my day job. And she's like, there's such a weird disconnect. Like, you're talking to a producer, or you're flying out to LA, you're doing something. Sure. And then you get back home and you're just like, well, how am I going to pay the rent this week? Like,
right. It's that weird limbo phase you're still in. It's like, you feel like, oh, right, I finally broke in, but your life hasn't changed at all. Right.
Go ahead.
It was like that in that sort of limbo phase until the movie finally got made, but thankfully it happened fast.
And the thing is, I've had guests on the show too, that they've like literally their movie was like just released and they're still in their day job. Like, the money hasn't kicked in yet. They haven't really, you know, hasn't really started yet. But I do remember that when Buried came out, it was kind of like an indie film, a little indie film phenomenon because of the writing, the directing. The director did a fantastic job because how can you make a box interesting visually? Like, at a certain point, he did. It was brilliantly shot. But the story, did you conceive it always as a real-time movie? Like 90 minutes?
Yeah. Never leaving the box. I mean, again, but that was born out of, and I always wish I had a cooler answer. People ask me that a lot. Like, why did you make this movie? Why did you write it this way? It was because I couldn't afford to get him out of the box. Getting out of the box is expensive. Like, then you have to see the desert and all this other stuff. And like, I can't afford that. So, it's one of those cases where, you know, where you have, I was going to direct the movie. So I had a vision for what this movie was going to be. And Rodrigo Cortez came in and just, I was like, holy shit. Like, I would have made a decent movie out of this, I think, because I thought it was a pretty cool idea. But I'm like, he made it into something truly cinematic. And it was just like, wow. I was also as blown away as everyone else who saw it.
And that movie, and then it did gangbusters at the box office for the budget that it had. It was a really, really well received.
Internationally, yes. It didn't get a big release here in the US, but internationally it made like $20 million off like a $3 million budget.
Wow, that's crazy. Yep. And then just continue to grow Ryan's profile up more and more. So let me ask you then, after Buried, I always love asking this question. You have a hit now under your belt now you've got a bona fide hit and you're the writer of it, and there wasn't, to my understanding, there wasn't like 15 other writers on it that tweaked it and script doctored it or anything like that, right? So the town knows it's you. It's not a script doctor or anything like that that's come in. How does the town treat you? What's the next step? Do you do the water bottle tour? Like, what happened?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that was happening. Again, it's been a long time now, but that was happening before the movie even came out. That stuff was, and that was that limbo phase again, where it's like
you're meeting the CAA and stuff.
Yeah, right. You're like going to these meetings and meeting all these people, these producers and at these studios, and then you're like, well, just going back to your normal life at home. So that stuff was happening prior to. And then after you get on, you know, the lists, everybody, you know, the list you want to be on, and it's kind of like the incoming call business, which is great. And that was the case for a while. And so, yeah, I mean, but that's the nature of, and I think that's what, you know, that's, I think you learn with age maturity and just doing this for now. I've been doing this for over 12 years, I think, professionally. And it's like, you learn how like people are the toast of the town and they're the new hot cool thing, and then it's somebody else's turn, and then maybe you, it's your turn again down the line. But I think, you know, it's in a weird way, Alex, it's the kind of thing, like if I had found success when I first started out doing this, like all of this, you know, it may sound cliche to say, but I think it is true. It's like, I don't know if I would have been mature enough to handle it, because especially when I wasn't the flavor of the moment anymore, because it is a very fleeting moment. Mm-hmm. Where kind of within like, oh, well, I was like, you guys made me think I was like cool and I was the shit. Now all of a sudden I'm like, you know, how come that doesn't feel like as much anymore? And, you know, I think I was settled enough in my normal life and mature enough because I was older to be like, yeah, I'm just going to keep working. You know, I'm just going to keep hustling and working. That's not going to change. And then come what may.
Yeah, like I had Troy Duffy on the show, who's obviously infamous for Boondock Saints, and he had all that success at the beginning of his career. And I told him straight up, I'm like, man, I don't know if I would have made a whole lot of maybe slightly different decisions than you would have made during that time. But at 20, imagine if you would have had that kind of success at 24, 25, right. You'd self-implode.
Yeah,
you'd self-implode. It takes a strong, mature 25-year-old. Not that there isn't any, obviously, but I wasn't that guy. That's for damn sure. I would have been eaten alive myself.
Yeah, I'm sure I would have too. The fall would have hurt. I mean, because I was used to the climb, the trying to climb. You know,
sure,
like that,
sure.
You know, the pushing the boulder up the hill, as it were. Like, I was used to that, and I was fine with that. But when all of a sudden you get to the party and all, and then like, whoa, what happened? You know, that like that would have been tough to, I think, kind of deal with as a younger guy.
Yeah. And a lot of screenwriters and filmmakers coming up, they don't understand that. They if they're lucky enough to get that moment, and it doesn't have to be huge. You don't have to be like Blair Witch or Paranormal Activity. You can have slight, smaller victories. Get into Sundance or, you know, something along those lines. You get a little bit of attention on you. That moment is very quick, especially in today's world. I mean, it was a little longer when you happened, like, you know, 12 years ago, that window was open a little longer because there was less competition and the world was a lot different. But now it's so short. And if you don't hit when that door is open, if you don't crash in with something, did you have other scripts? Is that, I mean, obviously you had other scripts ready, right? Or no?
Yeah, I did. My next movie, the one that came out after the one I did, is called ATM, which did not turn out well. I mean, it wasn't horrible, but it wasn't reviewed well. It was, and it came together fast. It kind of came together in the course of kind of as a follow-up to Barry, another contained little movie. And, you know, you kind of, you know, hindsight being what it is, you look back and say, I probably should have waited instead of rushing into my sophomore effort, as it were. I should have waited to do something a little stronger, I guess. You know, because it was after that I saw the kind of the fall off. That movie was like, all of a sudden the poster said from the writer of Barry. So it was like, whoa, like this means it's, you know, there's value there. Then all of a sudden that movie didn't do well. That means like it was me that really took the hit. Mm-hmm. I feel, and I blame myself. I mean, the script I thought was okay. It was good. But again, it was, you have like this energy because you finally get there and you want to like keep it going because you worked so hard to get there and everything else. But then, you know, after that though, but what you realize too is the work matters. Like the struggle matters. It does, because I always look at it this way. And I don't know how you feel. I always look at it as though I started off with nobody in this industry, right? Like a lot of people. I'm not unique in that way. It's like a lot of people. And even up till now, frankly, where I'm like, wait a minute, now I know, like, I've been doing this for 12 years. I know all these frigging people. Like, why am I going to stop working as hard? It's like, mm-hmm. No, I'm going to work just as hard, if not harder, because now I have more, like, all the resources. Opportunities in the world. Like, I can't, yeah.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
And so, I mean, that's kind of what happened after, I think, my second bill with ATM, where it was kind of like the phone stopped ringing as much, you know? Uh-huh. And it was like, what's going on, dude? Like, what is going on? I'm not the belle of the ball anymore. And it had the struggle, I feel, like the culmination of all those years, or what made me realize, no, dude, you have to fucking get back to work. You have to create more content. You have to turn this around. And frankly, I had now done two of these very, very small contained movies. I was like, I at least need to think bigger. I need to change the industry's perception of me. And that's what led me to write The Sea of Trees, where I was like, this is going to be, you know, because no one's going to do it for me. You know, I've got to change the narrative here.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's a lot of writers and filmmakers coming up don't understand that Hollywood is, they love to put people in boxes, because it just makes it's easier to categorize, and you're like, okay, he's the guy who does the contained movies. If we have a contained idea, we'll call him. Or, you know, oh, he just does action, or he's just a comedy writer. He's a polished guy or gal who just does polishes for comedy or joke writing, dialogue writing, or, you know, things like that. And it's your job to break out of that. And it's, some people love staying in their box and they build an entire career out of their box, but it's hard, especially if you've been in a box for a while. You weren't in a box for a while, but if it's hard once you're in that box, to change perceptions. And Sea of Trees arguably is a little bit different than Buried.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, I will actually push back a little bit on what you're saying. And even to this day, I still find myself, people with that perception of me are like, oh, you write these small contained movies.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, and we'll get to Greenland, I'm sure, but that's largely where Greenland was born out, where it's like,
oh yeah, really?
What the hell?
I'll show you.
Because, like, yeah, right. I mean, look, I've been a stubborn bastard. Not stubborn in a mean way, but like, if someone told me when I was younger, like, oh, dude, you can't, like, playing basketball, dude, you know, you can't shoot. That's it. Fucking next day, I'm out there in the snow shooting all day long. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And it's going to go through my head over and over again. Early on, I'm sure we all have these stories. I remember very early on, I talked about that. No, if you want to call it a movie, I made the first one. I remember going to a small, again, this is a sign of the times, to get a replication done of the DVD. Oh, yeah. I couldn't even do that myself.
Right. It's not a duplication, a replication, which is a different. Yes. You went to go get the Glass Master made back in the day. Yeah.
Yes. So I go to this small little video place here in Rhode Island, mm-hmm. right? That I don't even know what they specialize in, but whatever. There they are. Currently the only place I can find that does it. And there are a couple guys that are, you know, they're probably, honestly, they're probably my age now, but back then. And like really just kind of like rejected, sort of like cynical people. And so I was like, you know, this young kid, I mean, like, you know, I'd love to, you know, I was hoping you guys could do here. You know, I need this done. And kind of looking at me with this kind of almost like sneering sort of look, like, well, so what do you want to do? And I told him, I was like, I want to make features. And they kind of looked at each other. It was almost like a bad movie scene, like a scene from a bad movie. Like they look at each other, roll their eyes. And the guy says something to the effect of, yeah, kid, we all did. Like, is it to say, like, it's not going to happen. This is what you're going to do. You're going to be doing what we're doing. Right.
Right.
And like, I clearly remember that to this day, because I was like, fuck you, motherfucker. That's not going to be me, because that's not, you know what I mean? That shit to me is like fuel,
right?
You know, that sort of stuff. People saying I can't do something. And, you know, it's, I've never, you know, again, like a lot of people, I'm not unique in this way. Things never really came easy to me. Like, mm-hmm. I was not a gifted writer. I was a pretty good writer growing up. Whatever it is, you know, and so this stuff has taken me a long time, whereas other people probably took them half the time. Where was I going with this? But anyway, so So with when ATM comes out again, I mean, you take a few hits because you're like, oh man, no one, phone's not ringing anymore. I was like, no one's going to do it for me. Like I have to go again and show that I can do something different. And Sea of Trees was a drama, you know. I was like, I'm going to go, not at all what I've done.
Right, and it's a completely different kind of drama than what you anything else that you've done. One thing I wanted to kind of touch on about that kind of not to demean it, but the spunky attitude of the East Coaster. We have chips on our shoulders. I'm an East Coaster too. I was raised in New York, but then you know, spent most of my time down in South Florida. And when you're coming up as a filmmaker on the East Coast, or arguably not only East Coast, but arguably outside of LA, you've got a chip because you've got to struggle that much harder to get anything going. Like that you made a movie in the 90s on a DVX-100A in Rhode Island for 20 grand. Like you said, it's a miracle. You know, I did something similar in 2005 with the DVX. And it's just like, I can't believe, I look back at it, I'm like, how in God's green earth did I do that? Like it's, but there's a thing. And now, and you've lived in LA obviously, and I live in LA for 13 years. When you get out to LA, you realize it's just, it's everywhere. It's everywhere. Every Starbucks you walk into has Final Draft on all the laptops. You know, I always say the joke when I walk into it, when I get an Uber, pre-pandemic, when I used to jump into a different world, I used to jump into Uber and I would say, how'd the audition go? Or how's the script going? Like without even saying hello. And they're like, how'd you know? I'm like, you know, I mean, I don't know if this has ever happened to you in an Uber. I actually had a composer like bust open like music. This, like, cause I told him, what do you do? I'm like, oh, I'm a director. And they're like, well, I have some music. I'm a composer here. And they would like play them. And it was so bad. I was like, I didn't. And he's like, can you tell me the honest truth? I'm like, do you want me? You want me to be honest? And I'll be constructive, but I'll be honest. And I gave him the honest review and you could just see, just deflated. I'm like, I'd rather you hear it from me, man, than if you go into a room somewhere. If you get into the room somewhere and you play that, it's not ready.
Yeah, but that's the sort of stuff, honestly, not like you hear that, you get deflated, but then you go one of two ways. Mm-hmm. Either you're like, you stay deflated, or you're like later on
that screw day, that like, guy.
You know what? Fuck that fucking guy. I'm going to make myself better. But you take the lesson. You're like, there's something to be taken from that. I had that again. I'm talking way too much about a movie that I'd rather not talk about at all. But nonetheless, that same movie, I remember showing it to some like filmmaker in Boston. Again, I don't mean to keep using the word hustle because it sounds like I'm just sucking up to you.
But it's fine. It's fine.
It always was.
You have to send me a dime every time you say the word though, but that's okay.
Yeah, right. But like in the course of that struggle, that hustle, like I remember finding this filmmaker in Boston. I was like, again, well, there's a filmmaker. I have to try to reach out to them. I have to talk to them. And I remember I sent him the movie and I was like, oh God, like he might like my movie, this guy.
Oh God.
And I remember getting an email back and it was something to the effect of like, I tried watching it, but I turned it off after half an hour. And I was just like,
that's like, rough.
Like a gut punch of like, you get it, you know? And what do you do at that point? Either you just go, I guess one of three things. Either you say, well, I'm just not cut out for this and that's the end of it. Or you just, I guess, stay, you accept the fact that you're not good at it and continue to be not good. Or you recognize there's constructive criticism in there and then you get better. You know, you have to keep working till you're better. There was something else I was going to tell you.
Well, I was going
to. That's okay. We'll get to it.
And I don't mean to sound like I was being a dick to that poor guy in my Uber driver who was sending me the composer, but the thing is that and I got hit. God, Jesus, with my films. I mean, I would send them out, and I would get just, you know, people wouldn't like it, but then some people would love it, and it's like, am I put out for this? Is this the thing? And at a certain point, the universe is going to continuously throw punches at you constantly. They're going to be throwing crap at you. It's going to test you all the time because arguably this is one of the most difficult businesses in the world to break into.
Sure.
It's just a very brutal business to break into. And the universe continuously is going to test you and test you to see if you've got the metal to make it happen. There's always the there's always the Robert Rodriguez story. Everyone always talks about the Robert Rodriguez story or the Paranormal Activity or these kind of lottery ticket. Even Eddie, you know, when I talk to Ed, I'm like, Eddie, you are a lottery ticket. He goes, but then when you hear the story of how he got Brothers McMullen, I'm like, dude, that was brutal as well. But you got it. I think the universe tests you. Like, do you have the metal to keep going? Because the people who actually make it in our business, and you've been in the business and have had a lot of successes and know a lot of people. Arguably, it's not always the most talented. It's not the nicest.
No. No, it's not. You know, yeah, it's not. I mean, on both sides, on our side and say the executive side,
all sides of all the business. But it's like, but it's about who stuck in there, who didn't give up, and they're the ones that make it. And there's, I know some talented screenwriters, man. Whoever reads their scripts, I'm like, why hasn't this been produced?
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
It's just great, and you just like, sometimes it pops, sometimes it doesn't. Like, it's the way the world works. I don't understand it. But like you got to keep going.
Yeah, I mean, there are talented people, a lot of talented people that are truly waiting to be quote unquote discovered. There are a lot of people out there that are, you know, they've made a career and you wonder how sometimes. And that's, like I said, on the executive side, I've met some really, really great executives. They're like, these are brilliant men and women that you're like, you know, it makes perfect sense why you're successful as you are. And occasionally though, you come across someone and you ask yourself, like, how did you even get your job? Like, how did you, you know, last this long? I mean, because it's shocking, you know, sometimes.
It is. Oh, God, I've seen them. Oh, God. Oh, no. Look, in my post days, when I had my post house, I would get these guys come in and it's like, you know, some 24-year-old who got $3 or $4 million to make their first feature. And I'm sitting there like stewing as I'm color grading or editing the project. And I'm like, yeah, do you want me to make this look like a little Blade Runner-esque? And they're like, I've never seen Blade Runner. I'm like, get out of my suite. What is wrong with you? Like, how did someone give you $3 million? Why did I get that $3 million? God damn it.
Yeah. And it's just how it works out for everybody. You know, it's the kind of thing, like, no one listening to this is going to say, oh, that's what Chris Farland did, so that's what I should do. No, don't. Like, don't, because it's not going to – your way is going to be your way, and not to sound like an old man, but it's the truth. It's like this isn't – these aren't the hard sciences. Like, if that's what you're looking for, if you're looking for a profession where you get concrete answers – go become a mathematician, I guess, or a scientist, where you could say this is just a fact. Like, I know this for a fact, and I accomplished this, and this is what it is. It's settled. This is the kind of thing where we're all doing our best and hoping that the stars align when they do. There are certainly more tried and true, I guess, approaches for sure. But at the end of the day, I think it really just comes down to kind of, you know, the amount of effort you're putting in.
Did you make the same mistake I did? Because when I was coming up, Robert, Eddie, Rick Linkletter, all these guys, you know, Kevin Smith, I just kept looking at all their paths. I'm like, well, I'm going to do what Robert did, or I'm going to do what Kevin did, or I'm going to do thinking that I was trying to hack the system, man. I was trying to figure out a way. I'm like, how can I get in? Okay. Well, they snuck into the party this way. Maybe I can go down that road. And the thing is that every one of those, the door slammed behind them because it just was their time with their project at that moment. You know, when I had Rick on the show, and I think I even asked Eddie this, I go, do you think Brothers McMullen would make it today? And I think Eddie said, probably not. Like, there's just too much. This is not the time for that film. It was at that moment, you know? So did you make that mistake?
I think all of us do. You know, it's like that it's part of the process, right? Even say just finding your voice. Like at first we're all like cover bands, right? Like that's the way we learn to play, is that we play other people's songs at first. And so like,
that's a great analogy.
Eventually it's like
Eventually
you want to kind of do your own thing. And so you learn to, but what I think the takeaway is what you can emulate or copy, even what they did, is that they did it. Like they went out and did it. You don't want to copy what they did. You want to just copy the fact that they actually got off their ass and did it. And I have to imagine this is your experience as well. There's something so interesting about this business, because there are so many people that are in, you know, so many of us are always talking about the things we're going to do and going to make. And that's on our side, on the executive side. It's right. Like all these projects in development and et cetera, et cetera. And it's all, and it's not to say that it's just bullshit. Sometimes I suppose it is, but like it's, these are all like desires. Like we want, and it's amazing thing when you are making something, it's amazing how people just lean in and they're like, whoa, what? And I had that experience. I had that experience when I did a small movie called The Atticus Institute with Peter Safran. And so I made that movie. That was like a $200,000 movie that we did. And it was a good little movie, in my opinion. But anyway, I'm in post on it in LA, meanwhile doing some meetings, et cetera, et cetera. And I wasn't really even mentioning it. You know, like they just came, also, oh, what do you come into LA just for the meetings? I'm like, well, usually that's what I'll do, but I'm here because I'm in post. I was like, oh, I'm in post on a movie I'm doing. And you watch as they're like, what movie is that? And it, the blinders they could put on, because I think there's just something, and it happens to me. A buddy of mine just made a movie and I'm so proud of him. He's been in LA, an actor friend of mine. Like he's been in LA for 20 something years or whatever it's been. And he went out and produced and wrote and produced his own movie. And I was like, yeah. And I was like, and I find myself, I'm like, holy shit, man. Tell me about it. Yes, because it's real. Like it's what separates you from a lot of people who in our business just talk about making movies or talk about making this or that. And I don't know. That's what I think you can take from people like Robert Rodriguez and Eddie, where it's, and I said this, I've actually spoken to Aaron, Eddie's producing partner, since hearing them on the podcast.
Oh, did you?
I told him, I was like, yeah, I was like, reached out, I was like, hey, I heard Eddie on the podcast, et cetera, et cetera. and I told them, you know, those guys, that story inspires me all over again every time, you know, where I hear what they did and what they're doing currently. Because believe me, I'm not dumb. I recognize that I'm talking from a pretty privileged position now where I'm a working writer. I get, you know, hired to write and rewrite stuff, et cetera, et cetera. So it's easy for me to kind of make this cavalier statement of like, fuck it, man. I was inspired. I'm going to go make something of my own. Well, you're already making money. You're lucky. Right. But, you know, to be fair to myself, I was the guy on the other side for a long time, a very long time, you know, just trying to hustle, trying to whatever. My point is, I heard them like what they always call McMullen 2.0.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just inspiring every time I hear them where it's like, you know, and I've talked to them over and over about it too, where it's like, man, tell me about it. Tell me about how you guys go out and you're making movies for whatever else for very little money, all, you know, relatively speaking. And, you know, something they said early on, which I thought was really, really interesting is like, it's like, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter ultimately how many people are behind the camera. Mm-hmm. People don't know. If it looks, you know, you want to make something professional, but they don't know. They see what's in front of the camera. So don't get caught. Basically, just saying, don't get caught up in bells and whistles that maybe we now, you know, it's like, well, you need this, you need that. It was like, remember, go back to the beginning. Mm-hmm. No, you didn't. Mm-hmm. And you end up not doing stuff because you think you need all these extra things. And the same thing with, you know, we were talking before about like maturity and saying like, what happens if we were successful at, I mean, look at M. Night. Like M. Night was being called the next Spielberg at like what, 26 years old or whatever it was. Now I know Night fairly well. I did a project with him and I got to know him and I got to know like his producing partner, cousin Ashwin. They're just fucking great people. And, you know, without getting out of school, but like I was working, remember that project, the movie Devil that he did? Okay. So that was part of something called Night Chronicles, that Night was going to be kind of godfathering three projects that he was going to produce, but he wasn't writing or directing, but they were his ideas. Devil's the first. I was brought on to do the second one. It just ended up never happening. Long story short, this was all occurring. Like he brought me out to his fucking ranch in Pennsylvania, whatever. It's occurring at a time when he was like, I think he had done Last Airbender. He was about to do After Earth. Yeah, it was a tough time in the M. Night sagas. So I saw all that and I saw him just on a human level kind of being like, you know, this is kind of the shit we're talking about now. Like, right. It's like the same conversation of like, fuck, man, like what's going on? Like, how do I get, you know, get the engine going again? My point is like, what, fast forward a few years after that, he puts up The Visit, where it's like a self-funded found footage movie. Now, to do that, to step back from being the next Spielberg, right, who made arguably one of the best movies, at least of our generation, with The Sixth Sense and maybe Absolutely. Unbreakable, right? Mm-hmm. To step back, check your ego, and say, I'm going to make a small found footage horror movie for like whatever amount of money, knowing full well people are going to be like, what, this is what you've become? Like, you've been reduced to this? Because it's like, he's like, no, I'm a filmmaker, so this is what I'm going to do. And I don't know. I give the guy all the credit in the world. I'm so glad that it worked because now his career is where it is again. I don't know. I guess I'm just saying, like, I am so endlessly impressed by the and Aaron doing it, by Knight doing it, and it's just so inspiring of a thing.
I mean, I'll tell you, when I've been a fan of Knight since Sixth Sense. Like, everybody who saw Sixth Sense was just like, you know, Unbreakable, arguably one of the best superhero movies of all time, as well. And I saw the decline, you know, with Last Airbender and then After Earth, you know, where everyone's like, he's done. It's over.
Right.
It's over. And what he has single-handedly reconstructed his career to the place where it is today. And it is a success story that is not spoken about enough because people love to crap. Everyone loves to see the Giants fall. They all love to see the Giants fall. I remember, in 90, after Hook, Spielberg's over. It's done. He's good. He had a great run. It's over. I loved Hook, by the way, but you know, it didn't perform as well as everyone wanted it to perform, and all this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And he's like, "Oh, really? Okay, I'm going to do the dinosaur movie, and I'm going to do Schindler's List on the same year. Right. Up yours." Then, as Spielberg should have. But M. Night, I mean, and now like his new movie Old, which looks, you know, terrifying. It's like he's again tapped into a fear that every human being on the planet has. Right. You know, it's amazing to see what he's been able to do with his career. But it is that thing that you were saying. It's like the, you know, Eddie is a filmmaker. Rick is a filmmaker. Robert's a filmmaker. At their core, and they're indie filmmakers, no less. They come from a generation. They're indie guys. And I love, like, when I used to watch Knight's behind the scenes and special features on his movies, he'd always put his short films. His like high school short films on there.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. You would see him like acting out in his own little short films. I'm like, he's a filmmaker, man. Like,
right.
He's a filmmaker. And no matter who you are, and I've had the pleasure of speaking to amazing people on my show, at the end of the day, I don't care if you've made $200 billion or you've made $2, filmmaker is a filmmaker. And it's and you connect at that level, even if it's Spielberg or if it's a new film student that just came out of film school. It's the same thing. And it's that hustle. No pun intended. It is that hustle that you can't let go. But so I wanted to go back to Sea of Trees, man, because people who don't know about Sea of Trees, it was directed by a young up and coming director, Gus Van Sant. Yeah. Dude, what is it like writing for Gus Van Sant? Like, if you like, we're referring to Good Will Hunting. Like,
right, I know. And
it's, what's that like, dude?
Real in that way, because it started, like I said, it started me on, as a writer, was Good Will Hunting, is, you know, that movie. And so I remember telling him that. And Gus is a very nice guy, you know, but he's Gus Van Sant. Like, he's kind of eccentric, you know, not in a crazy way, but it's like, you know. And I remember telling him, I told him that story. I was like, you know, it's interesting, you know, you and I are doing this right now as we were going through the script, et cetera. I'm like, it was your movie that inspired me to become a writer. I think it's kind of cool that, you know, here. And he kind of looked at me. He's like, well, I didn't write it. I was like, yeah, dude, I know that.
But you
is cool. You made the movie.
like Gus. Like,
fuck it. Whatever, man. Let's just talk about the script.
I'm like Gus, I understand that, Gus, because I saw the Oscars like everybody else did. And Ben wrote it. We know that. But you were a big part of that film, which inspired me to become a writer, sir. Because without you, Ben and Matt, God knows what would have happened to them.
right. So I mean, that was a wild, that project was a wild ride because, again, kind of what like prompted me to write it was, again, trying to break myself out of this box, no pun intended, that was pigeonholed in. And then it got into Cannes, and I was like, holy shit, like I have a project going to Cannes. That's amazing. And this was obviously after the movie had, you know, shot with McConaughey and Naomi and Gus and Ken Watanabe. So I was like, and I was a producer on it. So it was like, wow, this is amazing. And then it got to Cannes, and they did the I don't know why they do it this way, but they do. The press screenings before the real screening, like the red carpet screening or whatever. And the press fucking destroyed it. They booed it. They so I'm at my wife and I. And again, I mean, this is still fairly early in my career. I mean, it's like, you know, I had done Buried, I'd done this, but it's, you know, this was like a big thing, you know, to go to Cannes with a big movie star with movie Gus. And a big director.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Right. Like, so I'm like, wow, this is fucking cool. And I just remember being out to dinner and a friend of mine, a producer friend that guy that produced Buried, actually one of the producers, he's sitting at dinner and he's Spanish and he just kind of, he just happened to look in his phone and he just looks at me and goes, "Oh, Chris, I am so sorry." And I was like, "What, dude? What are you sorry for? What are you talking about?" And he just showed me the phone and it just said like, "Buried gets booed at Cannes screening." And I was like, "Oh my God, like, no, this can't be happening." And that night was tough. It was kind of like, I remember just going for a walk and, you know, it's the sort of thing. And maybe this is like an East Coast thing. And like, I mean, look, I grew up working class and you're used to kind of taking your hits. It's just the way it is. My friends and I, to this day, joke about it. It's like the Clash of the Titans. That's what we call it. It's like Clash of the Titans bands. Like, you know, little figurines that the gods play with.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and it was like, they see you doing a little too good. They have to knock you down. Like, and I like, and it felt like that moment. Like, I told my buddy, like, dude, Clash of the Titans, man. You know, it's like I can, but they fucking said, nope, you're not gonna get that far. We're gonna knock you down. And you know, so it sucked in that way. But thankfully, I think it was the next night or two nights after was the screening. And I mean, we got a 4-minute standing ovation, and it was nice. And did the movie deserve a 4-minute standing ovation? I don't think so. I think it was kind of like, it definitely didn't deserve to be booed. So we'll give you, I think it was a little bit of that built into it. You know, but the movie, I think the movie turned out fine. There were, you know, it's interesting to see it now because it's found a new life in recent years on Amazon Prime, where it seems like it's found its audience. And people, like, there's a certain audience that loves that movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think, again, there are, let's be honest, there are definitely like critics, like high-minded critics that, you know, they just, it doesn't meet their, I don't know, whatever it is, their the threshold for them, or doesn't cross that threshold, or doesn't reach a certain level for them. And so they're going to have to just destroy it. I think there are those people for sure. And I think maybe people who just appreciate the movie for the movie and the message and the themes, et cetera, I think it's like, and the filmmaking, don't get me wrong, the filmmaking as well. I'm not discounting that. I think it's been a nice journey to kind of by this point.
So, yeah. And it's, and don't feel too bad. I mean, the press at Cannes is infamous of being just brutal. Like they those press screenings, I've heard legendary stories of them just destroying things. And
yeah,
it is what it is, man. Like, you know, if it was me, dude, I'd be like, F you guys, I'm in Cannes. Yeah,
that's it.
I did a movie with Gus Van Sant starring Matthew McConaughey, Naomi Watts, Kiko Zombie, and you're just like, dude, it's not for everybody, but I'm having you had Sundance with Buried. So you hit like the double basically at Sundance, at Cannes, and not only at Cannes, but with an amazing cast, a legendary director. I don't care what anyone says at that point. I'm just happy to be nominated.
Yeah, that's the truth. I mean, like I said, it was another instance, Alex, of where like it's the gut punch. You feel it.
I take it.
No, but then you have to decide what you're going to do. You know what I mean? Are you going to say, that's it? This was my big shot, let's just say.
Yeah.
I blew it. Or you're going to say, fuck you. I'm going to get better. I'm going to at least try to get better. I'm going to, you know, maybe the next one you won't hate.
I hate to say it, but that's an East Coast mentality. That is really kind of like a working class East Coast mentality, you know, because, you know, it's just the way it is, especially when you're working class and you're coming up. You know, I was definitely the same as you. I mean, I was raised in Jamaica, Queens. You know, lived in an apartment. It was probably, I think, 500 square feet, you know, and, you know, you just take, you get used to getting hit. not physically, but like the world just pounds on you. And that's just, that's your path in life. And that's nothing wrong with that, but you get stronger. Your skin gets harder. You get more shrapnel on you, from the stuff that you go through. And those are the people that make it in this business. Not the, I'll walk right this way, Mr. Sperling. Come right on in. How much do you need for your project? Oh, 100 million. Here's 100 million. Right. That kind of scenario, if it does happen, and that's the only thing you know, the second you get tapped, you get flicked. You're on the floor, knocked out.
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now back to the show.
Yeah, you're fragile.
You're very fragile. And I think that's, I personally, as a filmmaker, I can't say I've enjoyed the struggle, but I appreciate the struggle that I've gone through throughout my career, throughout my life, throughout everything I've done, because it has made me who I am today. And arguably, when I do get punched, which I've said this 1,000 times on the show, we all get punched. I don't care who you are, how big you are, you're going to get punched by this business. You learn how to take it, and you just keep going like insane people that we are, because this is an insanity.
Well, because we love, you were saying before, it's like, because we love it, we love doing it. It's like, if it were something we hated, we'd be like, fuck this, why am I going to keep taking these hits?
Did you ever try, you know, did you ever try quitting?
No. When buried happened, though, I was approaching kind of that turning point where I was getting to be a certain age. My wife and I, she was my actually the girlfriend becoming fiance at that stage, you know, that's all part of life, you know, where you kind of reevaluate where you are. It's easy when I was a 20 something year old kid living in LA by myself with roommates as an actor. It's like, you know, and then even to say, you know, I just like, who, you know, your friends and family around you, like life changes, it's always changing. Like, and you find yourself in different circumstances. And that, I think that really does your decisions, and that being one of them, where I was at a stage where I was like, man, is this time to throw in the towel? Like, I've given this a go. Like, I can't, I can fairly say to myself that I've tried, right? Because it would be one thing if I was like, I kind of half-assed it. And I was like, no, I've tried. I've really worked at this. I guess the difference is, I was like, well, as a writer, there's really no reason to stop. I can continue to write. You know what I mean? It's like, that, you know, the acting thing is, as I said, at almost the outset of this, that's what makes it a particularly difficult struggle. Is like, there's really no other version of it. It's like, you have to be there. It's you. It's like, that's your the profession you want. And it's a very inconsistent profession, and so on and so forth. But like, as a writer, even though I was at that crossroads, I was kind of like, I don't know if this is going to happen. I don't know if I can continue with the level of output that I've been trying, you know, at for the past X number of years at that point. But I think I can continue to write because I like doing it. And I still think maybe there is a glimmer of hope in there for me somewhere. You know, and it's interesting because I look back at when Buried happened, and, you know, it's easy to add meaning and symbolism to shit, you know, after that. But, you know, like, it's... It really, if I can, there's, you know, in a way I felt like trapped, in a way I felt like I needed to break out, in a way I felt like time was running out, all of those things. And whether it was subconscious or not, or whether, again, I'm just like retrofitting it to make it sound cool, I don't know. But it's all, it's definitely true. All of those things are what I felt at the time I was writing it. And, you know, when we talked before about the stars aligning, right, at a certain time now, I personally don't believe in fate or deterministic or determinism sort of thing. I don't, teach their own. That's not what I'm saying. But what did certainly happen is that this was around 2008 that this all kind of started, this process with Buried. You know what I mean? Between starting to write the script and figure out how it's going to make it, et cetera, et cetera. That was around the time, that was the financial crisis. That was right after the, you know, 2008 when the, you know,
oh, the world was the world was upside down.
Yeah. So that, I think, factored into, you know, talk about the stars aligning. All of a sudden people were crunched for cash, you know, and I don't mean just people, I mean companies and, you know, studios and this. So all of a sudden it wasn't, you know, it was like the heyday of writing checks and big make, it wasn't happening as much because people were really, you know, paying attention to their bottom line and their ledgers. And along comes a movie where it's like, fuck, this movie could be made for like next to nothing. And I think that helped. I think the timing of it helped it because, and it happened again during the pandemic for me, where I can get to a project called Lakewood later. But again, I didn't set out for it to happen, for it to be, and I hate the term, but a COVID friendly movie, but it turned out to be, and this, you know, just happened to be, and it the stars aligned again, in this case for, you know, particularly bad reasons. But again, that's stuff that's out of your control. I don't know if I'd come along with Buried even a year earlier, people might have said kind of what my thinking was at the time, is that no one's going to give a shit about my guy in a box movie. Why are people in Hollywood going to care about that?
Right. And I'll tell you what, I feel you 100% in regards to symbolism in your script at the time, and you were trapped and all that stuff. I wrote a script that literally it was a revenge movie, and it was the DNA of that film is my anger towards the industry, the anger towards not being able to make it. And I'm like, I'm seeking revenge, and the bad guy is the industry for not giving me a shot, because God damn it. I might not be the next Spielberg, but I could definitely roll. You know, I could definitely make some movies. I've proven myself. Why the God damn it haven't I got? And the whole script and that energy was in the script. And I've gone back and read it a while ago, and it's just like, you can just sense the anger in it. It's really weird, but it was cathartic to get it out there. And I think, you know, sometimes that works well, like you with Buried. Sure. My script didn't get made, but it's still like, it was just really interesting. And I think writers sometimes have to pour that energy you have to switch between anger and bitterness. And I think there's a little bit of bitterness. Like, I think you've heard me probably say this on the show. If everybody knows an angry or bitter filmmaker or screenwriter, and if you don't know an angry or bitter screenwriter, you are the angry and bitter screenwriter.
You are one, yeah.
The one that everybody else knows. You were talking about being in a box. Again, this is coming back around to this box thing. But you felt, no pun intended, but you were in a box, and you're like, okay, so you're the small location, you know, one location kind of writer. Okay, now you've done Sea of Trees, and now you're the drama writer. But you really, it's still small. It's a small movie. You're not big. And you're like, oh, yeah? Well, then I'm going to make a big movie. And then you wrote Greenland. And tell me how that came about and how that whole project came to be. Cause I just recently saw it because I was dying to see it. When I saw the trailer, I was like, I love those kind of disaster movies. And I love Jerry Butler. And I wanted to see it. So I was like, when I found out you wrote it, I was like, oh God, I want to hear the story behind it. How did that get it done? Cause it was a runaway hit for what it was.
Right. Yeah, it was the purpose of it, really. I mean, I should back up. So I try to write at least one, if not two specs a year still. And, you know, it's just the stuff I like doing more because it's, you know, they're like my babies as opposed to me taking care of somebody else's baby, which again, I'm endlessly grateful for being able to do that for a living, to write screenplays for a living, and you know, people hiring me to do that. But at the end of the day, I just do like writing my own stuff too. So, so I was like, all right, how do I really kind of really just convince the town, frankly, that it's like, I don't just write small, not even contained, but just like small movie. I'd gone from being the guy that's read the very small, physically small movies, right? Yes. To like, I write these kind of smaller in scope.
Character pieces.
Yeah, right. Character pieces, right. And so I was like, all right, what end of the world movie, really? And so I came up with the idea, and I was like, you know, it had been at that point, and because you can't help but go back to when you hear things about like an asteroid or a comet hitting the Earth, or that it's like, all right, well, there's Armageddon. You can't help but do it. It's like Jaws. Anytime you mention a shark movie, you can't help but compare. Yeah. But I was like, but it had been long enough, I feel, since those movies had come out. And so, but I wanted to approach it in a way that still felt like my, you know, for lack of a better word, brand. Mm-hmm. And someone recently talked about Greenland to me in a way, and they used a term that I'm totally going to steal going forward, and I will right now, called a keyhole epic. And I was like, yes, that's what I wanted to do. And that is, you know, effectively having this epic thing happening. In this case, it's the end of the world. So this, you know, whatever it is, but in this case, that. But we're seeing it through the keyhole. We're seeing it through a very specific lens. And in the case of this movie, it's just we're following this one family, right, as opposed to checking on the president and checking on this, these people, that people, like the Roland Emmerich version, again, which I find interesting and fun. But it's a different movie than Greenland. And so what I tried to do in writing Greenland, I was like, no, I want to write the impossible. Like, what is the more fun version of the impossible?
Right. More fun.
You know, truly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, because that's pretty grim. It's a great movie. I loved it.
Oh, yeah, God.
Pretty grim.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, what is the more entertainment, I guess, based version of that? And without going too far in the other direction either, though, like, I didn't want it to become ridiculous and over the top. But I wanted to – so I kind of just stuck to what – I felt like by this stage in my career, I'm pretty good at, which is, again, just focusing more on the, like, the character seeing a very specific lens and or through a specific lens. And yeah, and that was it. And then it was just a matter of, like, what is going to make this different or potentially unique. And, you know, Greenland, like, why, not that you asked the question, but, you know, I'm sometimes hesitant to say it because it's weird how these days everything can be spun out, like, and become either political or like this or that or whatever, you know. But the truth is, see, like, this isn't why I wrote the movie, but allegory. Mm-hmm. The allegory that's built into that movie is about – it's about climate change.
Yeah.
And that's why I named it – why it's named Greenland, why they have to go to Greenland. It's not by accident. That's where I chose of all the places on the planet. Because I wanted to basically say, like, you know, with climate change, this is happening. This is happening, in, especially now as we say this. As we have this conversation, like, this is happening fast. But just because if it were an asteroid that was coming in like 5 days, we would be reacting accordingly. We would be, you know, we would be meeting what as best we can the moment to save ourselves. But because it's not happening that fast, we kind of act like we have all the time in the world, even though we know we don't. Even without an asteroid or climate change or whatever else, our lives are finite. And for some reason, I don't know if it's a defense mechanism as a species, but like we generally don't think about that. And we just go about our day, probably to keep us from going crazy. But the reality is we don't have all the time in the world and we do know it. It's only when kind of your world gets rocked by something, no pun intended, that like sometimes you wake up and you realize that, you know, and that's and not to go off on too on a tangent or try to sound like too fancy, but like that's the beauty of cinema at the end of the day is that movies take us to a place where we feel something and we walk out of it and we have the lived in experience that we would have had if it actually happened to us in real life.
Right.
But we don't have to suffer the negative consequences of it happening in real life. We still get the message. We still get the wake up call.
Right. If it's done right.
Yes.
If it's done right. I think a good analogy would be what smokers do or what people who eat fast food every day do. You know it's killing you. You know in 5, 10 years, 20 years, you're going to have problems if you keep down this road. But you just, oh, it's so far down the line. And that's what's going on with climate change right now. Until you either have that moment, which is heart attacks. Heart attack, you're like, yeah. Oh, I better stop. Or, you know, when the lungs collapses or something like that. Drug addict, any name your analogy. But that's where we're at right now. As opposed to, you're going to die in 5 days. You need to do something. And that's basically what Greenland is. And you're absolutely right. If there was a comet coming, we would react to save ourselves. But because it's so far down the line in our minds, even though we literally see the world burning around us.
Sure.
Literally are seeing the world burning around us right now with and freezing around us. Like that freeze of last year was insanity. It's like 60% of the country was frozen, you know?
Right.
And no one's like, that's okay. No, it's not, man. I don't remember that. I don't remember growing up when it hit over 100 anywhere other than like Death Valley. It was a rarity. Now it's like that's a common place. Over 100 is common. I was in Palm Springs. I was in Palm Springs the other day. It was 117. I don't know if you've been in 117, dude. 117 is literally like walking out into an oven into hell. I think I even got a little heat stroke because it was insanely so hot. And people in Palm Springs were walking around like it was 90. I'm like, you all savages, you're animals. I have no idea how you do this.
I don't know about you, and not to hijack this and make this about climate change, but I'll say this one quick thing. Since you grew up in the East Coast as well, mm-hmm. the indicator for me over the years has been when I was a kid, I remember going on Halloween, it was always freezing out. It was mm-hmm. cold on Halloween, right? Yeah. You'd have all the best intentions of wearing your cool costume, but you'd end up wearing like a winter jacket and on top of it, yeah. right? And ruin the whole thing.
Sure.
In the past 10 years, and again, this is just anecdotal, obviously, but in the past 10 years, man, Halloween, it's been like you walk around in like kind of like what I'm wearing now.
Yeah.
Where it's
yeah.
like this, it just
75, nice, 80. Yeah.
75, yeah. 80. It's like, it's a nice night. You know, it's like, you know, whatever it is, comfortable. Like mm-hmm. that was not the case when I was a kid. And again, purely anecdotal, doesn't necessarily mean a thing. It's just something that I picked up on personally. But to your thing about like saying, what would we do if we knew in 5 days that, you know, it was all going to end? Like, yeah, I mean, there's the version, obviously, not only would we be trying to scramble to save our lives, but we'd be doing what we need to do to settle our kind of emotional debts, if you will. Mm-hmm. Like we would tell the people that you've been wanting to tell that you love them and you haven't for whatever reason, because we all do it, you know, and that, or you would tell someone you're sorry, all those things. Like you would recognize, I can't keep kicking this can down the road. I can't do it. I have to do it now. And that's what I'm saying. Like that is, and I'm not talking about Greenland here. I'm talking about all movies. It's like mm-hmm. when they do it right, which the great ones do, is that you walk out of that movie theater and you remember that stuff. Like that's what I'm saying. Like you, it happens. It feels like it happened in real life to you, but the benefit is it you didn't have to suffer the consequences of it actually happening to you in real life.
Right. And that's, yeah, that, and if yeah, absolutely. There's no question. And before we move on, can we just touch upon how wonderful Armageddon is in the cheesiest, most wonderful goddamn way ever.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
My God, it is. Oh God. It's like, I love Armageddon so bad. It's like one of my guilty pleasures. It makes no sense. I think I remember listening to the commentary where Ben Affleck asked Michael Bay, like, hey, wouldn't it be easier to teach astronauts how to drill than teaching drillers how to be astronauts? And he's like,
right.
And Michael Bay is like, shut the fuck up, Ben. And at that point, I just kept quiet for the rest of the shoot. But no, if you guys haven't seen Greenland, you absolutely have to. And what are you working on now? What are your next projects? Isn't there a sequel to Greenland? I saw somewhere in IMDb.
So there's a sequel. Yeah. So that was announced at Cannes, the market this year. Mm-hmm. So that's happening, which is nice. Super exciting. So I've already written the first draft of that. So I'm sure in the next, I don't know, at least the next month is probably going to be a lot of doing the rewrite on that. Mm-hmm. And then I have two projects. You know, it was weird. Like this is obviously, it's been a weird year and a half for everybody. Just speaking only for myself here, we've been pretty locked down at my house. Up until, you know, we got vaccinated, my wife and I, et cetera, and kind of eased back a bit. But prior to that, we were very locked down. Mm-hmm. And so, but thankfully during that time, I managed to have two movies go, both of which I wrote and produced. And so one is, it is a smaller movie and that's okay. Called Intrusion. So that's a Netflix original, with Frida Pinto. So that's coming in, I think September mm-hmm. I sold, but don't quote me on that just yet. And then I did a movie called Lakewood with Naomi Watts. And mm-hmm. that was the one I referenced earlier where it was a movie we were setting out to make. And it just, the way it was written, it's very much in that buried model where it's like, you know, kind of one person more or less, the movie occupies and you know, shoulders the movie. And then COVID happened and it just became like, well, this is still a very makeable movie given what COVID restrictions are. And so the movie still got made. And it just was surreal because these things are happening. I'm watching live feeds from the monitor as if I was in Video Village, but I'm watching them from my home office here. And so it's, you know, my kids are running around in the background, et cetera,
really?
Et cetera. And
that's awesome.
Yeah. And I'm just, and you know, I'd be calling the director on my phone to communicate and seeing it, you know, just the COVID protocols in and of themselves are just like at the time, especially, you know, fully masked, full PPE with some people with the gowns on, some with the face shields, and just watching it from the somewhat voyeuristic perspective, it's like if someone walked in and saw that, they'd be like, what the hell is this? Is it? And I don't know, this is a movie being made. They're like, what? Like, yeah, this is, it looked like, I don't know, like as if you were in a hazmat tent somewhere, or if you were.
You were an outbreak. You were an outbreak.
Yeah, you were an outbreak, right. But this was a movie. This was just what it looks like behind the scenes making these movies. It's a huge, huge credit to the people that they're physically on the ground. And I was getting into my wife is high risk. So going to set was just simply not an option for me. And so it was just, you know, it was just amazing to see happen. So that's what's next. Those two projects. And then.
Well, so I'm going to ask you a few questions. I ask all my guests, sir.
Sure.
What are three screenplays every screenwriter should read?
Can I say Michael Clayton three times?
That's a good script.
It is the best.
It is a great script.
Let me see. That one for sure. That's just a given in the universe as far as I'm concerned. Trying to think of things I've read recently. I remember I read the screenplay for The Post, which I thought was really great.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. Yeah, that was a great movie.
Trying to think of what else. I like the screenplay for Mud. I mean, I'm not saying these are like the end all be all screenplays people must read, but they're just ones I remember reading thinking that's really good. I thought the screenplay for what the fuck was the name of the movie with Shia LaBeouf that he wrote?
Honey Boy? Yeah.
Yeah. I was blown away by that script. I was like, you know, because again, you think like, all right, so Shia LaBeouf decided he wanted to write a screenplay, we'll see how this is. And I hadn't seen the movie at that point or whatever else. And you know, and the script came in during award season. I was like, I was hooked. I'm like, this is a fucking good script, man. This guy's good. He can write. So again, I'm not saying those two are necessarily the ones that everyone must read. I'm just, they come to mind as really great scripts, but Michael Clayton, hands down.
What advice would you give a screenwriter or filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
The same advice. You know, like it's the cliche thing of saying, what would you say to your younger self if you could? Mm-hmm. I would say, and this is going to sound weird at first, I'll explain, get a job that pays you well. Okay. Now, if that's in the industry, great. But if it's not, like it probably is for people like me in Rhode Island at the time, mm-hmm. you know, it's mm-hmm. like I early on had far more success when, you know, in those incremental ways, when I had a good paying job, because especially I think because I started as an actor, it was so, there was like a fear of, this was before you could work as an Uber driver and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Sure, sure.
You know, it was like you were waiting tables and like, God forbid you had to go to an audition. It's mm-hmm. like, well, shit, I might have to, and the boss isn't going to let me go. Well, audition or waiting table job. I guess I have to quit my waiting table job and then go to the audition, hope I get it. But either way, I'm out trying to find a new job again. And it's like, you're barely scraping by. And so, you know, I think early on when I transitioned to kind of just say, I guess I'm a screenwriter now, is that I still had that mentality of like, I need to be available. And I would take, you know, I would take just jobs to pay the bills, mm-hmm. right? Because mm-hmm. I was like, and I would say, unless the job is completely occupying your time where you can't write, that's not great. But if you find a job where you can make a good living, where you have money in your pocket, man, because then you can do stuff. Then you can go make shit. You can go like, you know what? Like I was saying, I was able, because I had a pretty good job. It was nothing, a great job. Probably make at the time like $30,000, $35,000 a year. Mm-hmm. But it was enough to pay my bills and put a little bit extra money for me to save, to say, I'm going to make a $5,000 movie. I'm going to save up for it and make it. Because if you don't have anything, if everything is like hand to mouth and you're struggling, yeah. mm-hmm. it's tough, man. It's tough to think creatively. It's tough to, so it may sound like, yeah, no shit, dude. That's what kind of advice is that? But if you can, but scale it up. Where if you're like, dude, not only can you get a job that pays you well, what if you get a job that pays you really? Now all of a sudden, man, you have a lot of options. You can, you know, we all know that rich dude that fucking decided one day they wanted to be in the movie business and decided they wanted to be a producer. It's like, well, no shit. You can write a check for $1 million. You know, it's like, what's stopping you? You know what I mean? So I'm not mm-hmm. saying like find you paid like that. My point is more, it's, especially when you're young, you think like the struggling actor or the struggling performer or the struggling this, the struggling artist. I don't know. I don't know if it's a good thing. I mean, it's not. Keeps you hungry.
No. I got in. I was lucky enough and smart enough, young enough when I was young to get into post. And I was an editor. I just was an editor, and and that helped me become a filmmaker, because then I had always had post production when I went out for commercial shoots or something like that. I would throw in post production, but that's how I made a living. I never had an outside job ever. I always had a job in the business. Always had a job in the business. But the problem was, and this is the only kind of pitfall of having a good paying job in the business even, is that you're focusing so much energy on the good paying job sometimes that you don't have enough energy or time to chase the real dream. Because my dream wasn't to be an editor. I just did that to make a living. And I loved it, but I wasn't going to just be an editor for the rest of my life. Not that there's anything wrong with it. It just wasn't my path. And I literally had to just retire from editing, just because at a certain point, like even when you're making money, you're like, you know, someone shows up, like, I have 30 grand for you to post my film. You got to be at a special place in your life to just turn around, to turn off 30 grand, you know, just like, I don't want that money. Sure. Because 30 grand is 30 grand, especially if you have kids and a family and all this stuff. But at a certain point, you're just like, either I keep going down this road, or I start following where I need to go and be intelligent about it. But that's exactly what I did until I finally closed down my post house, and I haven't done post since after Indie Film Hustle and all that stuff, you know, took off. But there's that. But I was 20 years doing that. So it took me a long time to get to that place.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing it did clearly is that it afforded you the opportunity to you know, maybe it kind of at times was like caused mental burnout and created an obstacle there, but at least afforded you the opportunity to do stuff you wanted to do.
Shorts.
Instead of, again, things,
yeah.
Yes, right. I mean, right. We all have, but it's a different world now. Obviously, the technology is there. You can do stuff very, very inexpensively now, which is great, mm-hmm. which is even more the reason why people should and could be doing it. But what I would add to, on top of the hopefully worthwhile thing I just said about the job, is if you get a job in the industry, great. And I think there's obviously 1,000 great reasons why you should. If you don't, that's not the path you take. Mm-hmm. I would have told myself, again, my degree's in criminal justice. I've yet to really use them in any meaningful way. If I could go back, I would say, Chris, all right, tell me what you want to do. I want to be a filmmaker. Okay. At the time, film school wasn't an option for me. Okay. Well, then what I would say is, go major in business. Go learn how business.
Oh,
works,
God bless right? you. Yes, yes.
and go, and then take what courses you can take in film. Whatever ones are available, go take filmmaking. Whatever you can take. But if you can get an understanding of how business works, it will just be, you just map that understanding onto this business, because that's what it is. And it'll just kind of like create this, almost like it decodes it for you in a way, I feel. Because if you look at it strictly from the view of the artist, if you look at it strictly from the view of like the pie-eyed or wide-eyed kid that wants to get in the candy shop, like, you don't recognize that that candy shop is a business. And the people that run that candy shop want to make a profit. And mm-hmm. it's not just about, you know what I mean? So it's like, and it's not to pop the balloon for people and to take away the hooray for Hollywood stuff. That's what makes it a cool business, right? Mm-hmm. But it's still a business. It's still a job. And I think I would have, to do it all over again, that I think would have helped me immensely, and probably would have shortened the journey, if it will, that if right. you will, like, it would have shortened the time it took to finally get there.
And last question, what lesson took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life? And you might have answered it, I'm not sure.
I would say this is it exactly, is that I forever did not read screenplays. So like, I'm talking like maybe 5 years into thinking I'm a screenwriter, where I would once in a great while open up someone else's screenplay and, you know, and read the books, et cetera, but it wasn't until I got a job working at a production company in New York. I was living in Connecticut briefly at the time, and I was a reader, you know, and I got paid like nothing. And then I did for, a screenplay competition at a certain point. And so now all of a sudden it was my job. Like I had to read screenplays and read screenplays. And I was like, you just start to see why something works and why it doesn't. And it just, I feel, just took my writing from wherever it had capped out at to somewhere new. And I mean, to be fair to myself, when I, again, us starting out are probably and presumably around the same time, it's not like today where you could just find any script you want like that online. Mm-hmm. You know, it was like you had to actually go find physical scripts somehow, some way. And then being in Rhode Island, it's like, how the fuck do you do that?
Right.
So again, people listening to this now might be like, yeah, no shit, dude. Why wouldn't I? But at the same time, I still find it. It's amazing to me where I talk to a lot of writers, young or old, but kind of coming up. And I can't impress upon that enough upon them, because it's amazing how many times people don't, where it's still like, oh yeah, I do once in a while. It's like, no man, read like one a week, at least.
Yeah. And read the masters, you know, Shane Black and right. Sorkin and Tarantino, and watch what these guys do and how they, like I've said so many times, the haiku of writing is screenplay writing, because you got to do so much in such a little amount of space, and see how they describe a scene in a movie. Watch the movie and see how they wrote it, and mm-hmm. and you go, oh, okay, so I don't need to tell you about the cover of the book on the shelf in the back in the description. Right.
Exactly. Yeah, because you don't know. I mean, it's like you don't know that shit. Well, right. You just think, all right, I just have to describe what's going on, so I'm going to write everything. And so that is the lesson for sure. The thing, or whatever the question was, that is the lesson.
Answer. And I have to ask you, just out of morbid curiosity, three of your favorite films of all time.
Okay. The Graduate.
Excellent.
Predator.
Oh, God. Amazing.
And probably Star Wars at the end of the day.
Can we just take a moment to appreciate how Predator is arguably one of the best action movies ever written and ever shot? Just
ever.
It holds today. You can watch it, and it's not dated because it's basically all in the jungle. So even though it took place in the 80s,
it's still
guns and a bunch of muscle-bound dudes. Predator still looks good. There's nothing janky about it.
Nope. No, it is the movie that anytime, if you catch it on, I'm watching it. It's no matter what, I'm watching that movie. It's phenomenal. I mean, and The Graduate for me, if I may kind of just elaborate a little bit. I remember so my very, very first year of college, I went to Providence College part-time because I didn't know, I'm giving you more information than you just asked me, but I was like, I loved like the question. I wanted to be a filmmaker or this or that, and I didn't know how to do that. And I looked at Rhode Island School of Design at the time, which is actually where Gus went to school. But there really weren't many film classes there yet, and they were kind of art school film classes, which I'm not knocking, but they weren't like, this is how you make a movie film class. And I saw that Providence College had a film, I think like film theory class or whatever it was. And, you know, up in that point, I was like a typical 18-year-old kid that like most kids, like I'd watched movies like Predator. Those are like the movies. That's what I watched all the time. Had no real film literacy beyond that. And we had to, you know, and that's not obviously what we were watching in this movie. We were watching like Black Narcissists and The Quiet Man and,
right.
You know, great film.
Red Shoes.
Right. Yeah, like, and so I like Double Indemnity, like these were kind of cracking over my world a little bit, but none of those movies, even Citizen Kane, honestly, none of those movies did it for me like watching The Graduate, where it changed my, rocked my world. As like an 18-year-old kid watching this, sitting there in this classroom, and it was a night class, it was with all adults. Mm-hmm. Right. And I'm like this kid, and I'm like, oh my God, like I've never seen a movie like this before, really. Like this to me was where, you know, I was never a fan, and again, teach their own. I was never a fan of older Hollywood films where the acting is so stilted and it felt so
unreal,
theatrical.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I felt like, but seeing The Graduate, even though it was like, whoa, what is this? What was going on in this era? And that kind of cracked open my world, and like wanting to see, you know, all the great 70s thrillers then, and then getting to like French New Wave with Truffaut and Godard, and like it just kind of changed the game for me. So I'm sorry, really, really going on with a long-winded answer there, but
Well, two things. One, I remember watching The Graduate on Laserdisc Criterion Collection. And I remember, because it was before, there was no film school for me at the time, I was listening to a college professor who was on the commentary track explaining and analyzing Graduate, which is one of the best commentaries I've ever heard. It was brilliant. It was such a brilliant film. And for me, that film was Seven Samurai. I saw Seven Samurai. I saw Seven Samurai and I was like, what's going on here? Like, how is this? How? I still argue that no one could frame an image. Just frame. No fancy camera movement. Just the composition was at a level that you just can't grasp. That's why Spielberg, Lucas, and Coppola all stole from Kurosawa, because you know, they all like bowed down at Kurosawa's feet, because you just look at Seven Samurai and High and Low and, you know, and Rashomon, and you're just sitting there going, what's going on? It was oh my God, we can geek out for at least another 4 or 5 hours, I'm sure, Chris. But man, listen, bro, thank you so much for coming on the show. It has been awesome talking to you. And I hope this conversation inspires and terrifies people all at the same time listening to it in a good way. So thank you so much,
yes, brother. Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
I want to thank Chris so much for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe today. This episode really was a masterclass on how to construct your own filmmaking career on your own terms. And Chris is truly an inspiration. So thanks again, Chris. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, head over to indiefilmhustle.com/499. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and leave a good review of the show wherever you are listening to this episode. Next time I speak to you guys will be episode 500. I can't wait for you guys to hear that episode. Thank you so much. And I got a little more surprises coming up for you, and the few episodes coming in after 500 as well. So thanks again for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Bulletproof Screenwriting Podcast at bulletproofscreenwriting.tv.